Yeah, shred away, baby. Hey, what do you say, guys? It's 7-Eleven. Hope you're having a lucky day. See what I did there? Hey, well, it's 3 o'clock. Time for another live installment, because last week's with Tony Luke. I hope you listened, either live or from WWDBAM.com, because it was such a – just I think just a great – he's such a great guest. Has so much to talk about. And of course, since we taped that interview a couple of weeks ago, Tony has successfully launched an initiative called Brown and White, hashtag Brown and White. And it's basically, his mission is to remove the stigma of heroin addiction. Because as Tony sees it, there's, you know, I mean, it's a disease, like, and people aren't sort of stigmatized because they have cancer or heart disease, and why should they be if they're addicted to heroin, which is just another medical issue and does not imply moral failing on anyone's part. So congratulations to Tony on the success of so far of that campaign. It was launched just about 2 weeks ago or so. And but we're back live, and we have a pretty cool interview. I don't know about you, but my favorite kind of, you know, original rocker, 50s rocker. Oh, yeah, there was Elvis, there's Chuck Berry and Fats Domino and the Everly Brothers. But my personal favorite has always been Ricky Nelson. And, of course, Ricky Nelson died in a plane crash on New Year's Eve 1985. But his legacy lives on in the bodies of his twin sons, Matthew and Gunnar Nelson, who you may remember from the early 90s as Nelson, a very big MTV kind of band, very big pop band for a while. But more recently, they have been really dedicated a good part of their careers to keeping the life and music of their father alive. So and they got a show called Ricky Nelson Remembered. I said it wrong in the intro that I taped, so forgive me for that. But it's called, I believe it's called Ricky Nelson Remembered, and it's going to be a Borgata Friday night. And it's just the guys from Nelson playing the songs of Ricky Nelson and talking about their father, both personally and professionally. So we're going to talk to Matthew Nelson, the bass player in the band, in a little while today. And I've always, ever since I was a little kid, watching him on, what was I? Oh, Ozzie and Harriet, The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. And it's really interesting because most people don't think of that family in terms of like a showbiz dynasty. But if you really think about it, they are like the ultimate American showbiz dynasty, because Ozzie and Harriet, way before they went on radio and then TV in 52, really where they became icons. A word that I use and everyone else uses much too often. But they were, you know, Ozzy was a very popular band leader in the 30s. And Harriet, this is before they married, she was an actress and singer of some note. And she actually co-starred in at least one, I forget which one, I think it might have been Flying Down the Rio, but one of the famous Fred Astaire, Ginger Roger movies. And then, of course, they did Ozzy and Harriet together. And then Rick became really, I mean, yes, Elvis was first on Ed Sullivan's show and so on. But in terms of coming in to American households on a weekly basis, Rick Nelson was really the first rock star created, you know, primarily by television, very historic, because we know how that works, television and rock and roll. House has worked over about 60 years now. And now then Nelson, they sold millions of records back in the 90s. So very interesting interview that I did, I guess, last week with Matthew, and I hope you'll stay tuned for that. I'm also hoping that Neil Zurin, who we haven't talked to in a couple of weeks, calls in on time to kick us off. If he doesn't, so be it. You know, that's showbiz, man. That's what, up and speak of the devil. So we're going to get to Neil in just a second or two. And I want to, check us out on Facebook. That's Showbiz Radio page. And also Twitter at Chuck Darrow. And I think – oh, no, it's not Neil calling. Sorry, my bad. My bad indeed. Well, you know what? Rather than let Bruce, let's just go with Bruce. Right, and if Neil calls, he calls. This is it. That's why I always tell you people, professional radio, do not attempt this at home. Just words to the wise. So are we there with Bruce? Hello,
Chuck,
Bruce.
Chuck. Chucky yeah. Boy, I am
hey,
here. I am
there you
here.
Go. Okay, good. Because we had to, because we were on tape last week. Usually you're here the first of the month, but we had to postpone to this week, which I didn't have a problem with that, because whatever time of day or week or year, you always have something interesting to say. Bruce, of course, is our jazz correspondent. So what's happening amigo.
Well, I must start out with a story that you'll get a kick out of. As you know, our friend Eddie Bruce is coming to the Ocean City Music Pier.
Yep, great venue.
Wednesday night, July 26th, with the Ocean City Pops. And he's doing a wonderful new show, which is a tribute. The name of the show is called A Night at the Latin Casino.
Right.
And I know that you have rather interesting memories of
absolutely.
The legendary Latin. And Eddie called me the other day, and he said, "You'll never guess who I heard from." I said, "Who did you hear from?" He got a phone call from the niece of one of the legendary owners of the Latin Casino, who I know you knew, Dallas Gerson.
Yep.
And Mr. Gerson's niece heard about this show, and originally we thought, oh, boy, they're going to get us in trouble for using the name of the Latin Casino. But actually, she is so thrilled that, and this is hard to believe, that anyone remembers the Latin Casino, much less celebrating it in a show, that she is requesting to be seated on the front row of the Ocean City Music Pier for Eddie's show. And I think that's great.
Oh, wow. Well, that's great that the show has. I assume that's kind of the unofficial family blessing. So that's July 26th, great venue, the Music Pier there at Ocean City. Very cool. What else? What else?
Well, you know, as you well know, Philadelphia has a legacy that goes back years and years and years of really introducing major talents to the world of jazz. And I'd like to identify two of them. One is really well on his way. The other will be on his way. The first is a trumpeter by the name of Josh Lawrence, who is the co-leader of a big small band, called the Fresh Cut Jazz Orchestra, and their recordings are getting 5-star reviews in Downbeat magazine, and they're really incredible. And actually, before Josh left Philly to go to New York, he took it upon himself to sit in with a little group called the All-Star Jazz Trio at the Prime Rib, if you remember.
Yep.
And Josh, along with another young fellow and a good friend, a vocalist by the name of V. Shane Frederick, will be appearing in one of our area's many free summer jazz festivals. This one is going to be on Sunday the 15th, this coming Sunday. It's called the Lancaster Avenue Jazz and Arts Festival, and it's free. It goes from noon to 7, and it is at Saunders Park, which is at 39th and Powelton Avenue. Now, let me tell you about Shane Frederick. The guy is incredible as a singer, as a pianist. He sings bebop, he sings standards, he sings everything. And wherever I go, this kid is there. I went to a jam session last Monday just to see if my hands were still working at the World Cafe Live on Walnut Street. And sure enough, there is Shane. And I'm telling you, Chuck, that He's going to be the next big thing, and there's no one who deserves it more.
Yeah, remember, you heard it here first, guys.
Yes, he's off in the Chibo on Walnut Street in the Vesper Club, and the only thing that I don't care for is that he's better than I am. What are you going to do?
Hey, real fast, I want to just say that my dear friend Randy Alexander wrote a story a few years back for South Jersey Magazine, an exhaustive piece about the history of the Latin Casino. And if you Google Latin Casino South Jersey Magazine, it'll come up number one. And I urge everyone who is interested in stuff like this to read it. It is the definitive history of the Latin Casino.
So it's true. I've accessed it a couple of times, and he tells the Diana Ross story, the Jackie Wilson story, and I'll just add this, in that I'm the jazz guy. What a lot of people don't remember about the Latin when they moved to Jersey is that they had a lounge there called the Turf Lounge, and the Turf Lounge booked some of the leading jazz figures in the world, Jack Teagarden, Dizzy Gillespie, Gene Krupa.
Really?
And,
wow, that I don't remember.
I'm just waiting for Chuck. I'm waiting for them to bring it back because I'm open on Sunday.
Nice.
Now I want to. If I have a minute, I want to bring
it.
Up. We have a minute.
Yeah, a little bit less. But go ahead.
One of the bands that you fondly remember when we were coming up, one of the first to combine jazz and rock and country, Asleep at the Wheel.
Yep.
They are still swinging like mad since they were when they started in 1970. And Ray Benson is still up there, all 7 feet tall of them, swinging like mad.
A Philly guy.
And they're coming in on their latest tour, the Texas Dance Hall, Keswick Theater, Saturday, July 18th at 8 o'clock. And I'm going to try to be there because those guys are swinging like mad.
Cool. All right. Well, not a lot of time, but you got a lot of info packed in as always. Bruce, thank you so much. And we'll talk to you in a few weeks.
I'll see you at the Latin, Chuck. I'll be there.
Thanks, man. And we're going to go right to Neil, who did call in a little bit late, but we keep this thing moving. So let's get right to Neil. Hey, Neil.
There you go, the late Neil Zorn.
The late Neil Zorn.
They're not words. Let's hope they're not words that people speak anytime soon.
Let's hope not.
But there you go. And I've been to the Latin. I was at the Latin in New Jersey. I was never at the Latin on the Walnut Street, no matter what you've heard.
Well, that's because I heard you spend all your time hanging out with Lillian Reese at the Celebrity Room.
That's right, because you know, Frank and I just wanted to see Frank. He and I were buddies. He used to guard me leaving Channel 10 every day.
Nice.
He was on the radio show, and I was on the television. I used to joke that he and I walked out. He actually said it to me. He said, Zorn, you always walk out the same time I do. I said, I need protection on these ballot humid lots.
One day I'll tell you my Frank Rizzo story. It's not enough time. I don't want to, but it's pretty funny. He gave two of my greatest quotes ever, two different times. Anyway, what's shaking, baby?
Well, there's a lot of things. Actually, summer television seems to be not all that great. I mean, I don't see anything outstanding coming up. There is Games of Thrones began again on Sunday, and there are some small things coming up. But
how about this Snowfall, which I haven't watched the first episode yet? But
yes, Snowfall is good. Snowfall is good. Because it's John Singleton, and because he knows how to make the drama of the situation. The situation isn't one that might interest you. It's about the cocaine trade coming in. The crack cocaine trade coming into L.A. But more than that, it becomes, in John Singleton's hands, it becomes more of a sociological look at an entire place, an entire time, and how things happen, and in some ways the inevitability of them, and in some ways the opportunistic is terrible, but I couldn't think of the word opportunistic advantage that people had to do certain things, and that's what makes a difference of it being a typical television show and a special television show. I mean, I there's a lot of subjects that have been boring me lately, drugs being one of them, because it just is so prevalent. And you just want to, you know, I'll tell you, the Holocaust is another, not because I think it's not interesting or not important, only because you want to see what's new. What are you telling me that's new? What are you showing me that I haven't seen in 17 other movies?
Right.
Or 17 other plays? And I think Snowfall does that. So I do think that Snowfall, is one that is worth a look at.
Okay.
The thing I looked at this week was, oddly enough, I decided that I'm fascinated by Netflix because Netflix is just putting out so much product, sometimes too much to the point that it dilutes the quality of the product. You can't depend. It's not like HBO where everything is going to be pretty much a blockbuster.
Right.
But even so, I'm not a video fan, and I don't like animation as much as a lot of other people do who are involved in movies and television. But I decided to watch Castlevania, actually. It's not Mania. It's Vania as in Pennsylvania.
Right.
And I was engaged in the first four episodes.
And I'm not really familiar with that. What just a brief synopsis, if you will.
Well, basically, a young woman of talent in 15th century Romania, I probably have relatives there, probably goes to Dracula and asks him to help her get past superstition and teach her science. Of course, the church finds her superstitious and ends up burning her at the stake as a witch. And then it becomes.
Well, hold it. Let me stop you there. When you say Dracula, do you mean Dracula, the vampire that we know from popular culture, 20th century popular culture and 21st, or the Vlad the Impaler, the inspiration, the legend, or supposed inspiration for Dracula?
Vlad the Impaler.
Okay.
Vlad the Impaler, who has a lot of the same qualities as the one we know and love so much.
Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, it begins, the minute Castlevania begins with you seeing skeletons on pikes.
Nice.
People obviously just... impaled. So you know when you get to the
And this castle, is animated?
It is. This is animated. It's based on a video game. Video game, and you can see the way the game comes in, because you see the hero, a guy named Trevor Belmont, comes in, and you can see him using just a whip and a sword to just do all, get rid of all kinds of villains and characters. And it's the same theme as everything else, but I just found it interesting. I found that I kept going, kept watching it, and kept being enjoying the characters. Of course, it has some things I don't like. I like when everything stays human and when there's no magic.
Right.
When you're using the Dracula we all know and love, there's already the vampire thing, so magic is part of it and supernatural is part of it. I like it when I like it when the belief in the supernatural is debunked, as in what happens with the church in this series. But the other thing is, I always wonder, when you're series after series, whether it's Game of Thrones, whether it's Castlevania, whether it's, name your movie, Star Wars, Star Trek, it's always about a group of good people trying to get rid of people who want to take over the Earth.
Right.
But I always wonder why, when that happens in real life, people object to it. That always stuns me.
That's a very good...
We'll build armies. We'll defend. We'll do this. We'll get pitchforks and knives even and fight in the streets. But if in real life, if there's an ISIS, we don't want to do anything about it.
Right. That's interesting.
Right.
Because their leader isn't an evil genius, you know, charismatic evil genius. That's why.
That's right. And also, it is also something else that makes me think of. I always ask the question, why Lenin or the Tsar, why not Kerensky? And I know that's his ancient history, and even I'm not that old. But my point to that is, why is it always the extremes and not the rational middle? Why do we have to have a Donald Trump on one end and another idiot like an Elizabeth Warren on the other end, instead of seeing, where's John Kasich?
Because moderation does not sell. Moderation yeah. equals wishy-washiness. Hey, we got to call it quits already. That was a quick segment.
We do.
But
okay.
Yeah, but we will pick it up again next week. I promise you.
One last thing.
Go ahead.
Kevin Hart is doing this. Kevin Hart is doing this thing where he plays a Lyft driver. It's called Kevin Hart Lyft something Lyft specialist or Lyft Lyft legend. Kevin Hart Lyft legend, and it's really very funny. He just picks up people as Lyft drivers.
Really, where do we see this?
It's on Laugh Out Loud, but all I do is just Google Kevin Hart Lyft.
Okay, all right, Neil. Thank you so much. We'll talk next week. Thanks, man. And we'll be back with my interview with Matthew Nelson right after this.
Dick Fox's Golden Boy, starring Frankie Avalon, Fabian, Bobby Rydell. Friday, July 21st in the Event Center at Sugar House Casino. Frankie Avalon, Fabian, Bobby Rydell, the Golden Boys. Reserve seats on sale now at SugarHouseCasino.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
So, let me tell you about the Kibitz Room, baby, at the Holly Ravine Plaza, 100 Springdale Road in Cherry Hill. Kibitz Room serves the Delaware Valley's best traditional Jewish-style food and everything from their to-die-for hot corned beef, hot pastrami, and brisket to their best-in-the-business Knishes Kugel and matzo ball soup is completely homemade and absolutely fabulous. So, whether for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner, and any and all of your catering needs, you know what to do. You go see my pal Neil Parrish and his crazy crew only at the Kibitz Room at the Holly Ravine Plaza, 100 Springdale Road in Cherry Hill. Call them at 856-428-7878 or find them at greatpastrami.com.
Stuck to the ground, and though I never did. late 1950s and early 60s, if Elvis Presley was the first name in rock music, Ricky Nelson was the second. Thanks to weekly appearances on his family's long-running sitcom, The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, Ricky Nelson had national exposure for such hits as Hello, Mary Lou, Poor Little Fool, I'm Walkin', Traveling Man, and It's Late. That, coupled with his almost supernatural physical attractiveness, made Ricky Nelson a superstar. But Ricky Nelson was also a rock and roll pioneer. He was as responsible as anyone for the popularity of rockabilly music during the latter part of the Eisenhower administration. And years before he became known as Elvis Presley's musical lieutenant, guitar legend James Burton played in Ricky Nelson's band. Rick Nelson, as he was known in his post-Teen Idol days, died in a plane crash on New Year's Eve 1985 at age 45. But for years, his music has lived on via his twin sons, Gunnar Nelson, and today's guest, Matthew Nelson. Matthew and Gunnar are no strangers to musical success themselves, having been stars of the early 1990s as leaders of the band called Nelson. But these days, they devote a large portion of their time to their presentation, Remembering Ricky Nelson, which celebrates the life and music of their father. Friday night, the brothers bring the program to Borgata Hotel, Casino, and Spa in Atlantic City. Matthew Nelson, welcome to that showbiz.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show, and I am really looking forward to coming and playing with you guys.
Great. Can't wait. Just such a huge, huge Rick Nelson fan. I've been since I was probably 5 or 6 years old. Used to watch him at the end of the episodes. So anyway, let's start by walking through the show.
Sure.
Tell us what we can expect if we go see and when we go see Remembering Ricky Nelson.
You got it. Well, actually, technically, the show's called Ricky Nelson Remembered.
Oops, I'm sorry.
Don't even worry about it. It's cool because we're still going to show up and put on the same show.
I don't know where I got Remembering Ricky Nelson from. I guess I thought I'd read that somewhere.
I don't know. Maybe we should change it.
Holy mackerel.
It's okay. We actually put this show together really more out of, there are a couple things that kind of coincided to make it timely. I mean, the fact was Gunnar and I sold 10 million records and people had no idea who our dad Ricky Nelson was. And so we'd already made our mark, you know, we'd had our own number one records and stuff like that. And, you know, we kind of, you know, when I got a call and found out that we're the only family to have three generations of number one hit makers in the Guinness book, I thought, okay, I think we've kind of established ourselves. We have so many people coming up to us, asking us to play one or two of our dad's tunes in with our show. We felt that it was really, it wasn't respectful enough for him. You know, there was one thing I got to say about our pop. He was so incredibly good looking, and he had kind of, what people would think was a TV-based success, that there was kind of a little bit of an onus, to be really honest.
Sure.
That it wasn't real. And the truth was, in Europe, they didn't get the Ozzy and Harriet show, and he's just revered as a rock star. I mean, Paul McCartney, we have a clip of him in our show, says, you know, back in England, we knew nothing about the Nelson family. Ricky was the famous Nelson, and there's none of that weirdness. And the whole point was this. We had so many years of his life documented on film. I mean, you can argue that our dad was the most televised rock star in history. There were 435 episodes of Ozzy and Harriet.
Wow.
There were so many of his musical performances that, like yourself, you know, you tune in and watch him, whether it be reruns or the first time around, watch Ricky sing. And it was real. It was genuine. And it was really, as you said before, it was at a time where he was kind of like a rock and roll sleeper cell. He smuggled it into American living rooms. And, you know, only he and Elvis are the only two biggies never to be on American Bandstand. They didn't need it.
Right.
You know, you had to watch Ozzy and Harriet to see him. And Elvis had his outlets too. But they're the only two guys in the 50s that had number one rock albums. Nobody else did that. But our pop wound up selling, I think, 290 million singles.
Wow.
And he's in the top 10 of all-time selling recording artists. He did it very quietly. But it's one of those things where when you come to see our show, we have a combination of – it's a high-energy rock and roll show meets an A&E biography with large-screen video with everybody from, ourselves, Chris Isaac, Paul McCartney, John Fogerty, all these people talking about him, and our dad, of course. And it kind of goes through his story. It parallels his life. And if you think about it, what he was going through really kind of paralleled what America was going through. And I think – it's notable that he reinvented himself spectacularly with Garden Party, which
yes.
was a song that
and
he wrote.
I actually want to talk about that. I'm going to get to that in a
yeah.
couple of minutes. Yeah, absolutely.
You got it. So, I mean, I guess what people are going to see is that we look at it this way. When Gunnar and I go on stage and perform this show, it's bigger than we are. You know, we are representing our entire family up there. So we take it really seriously. It's not just, hey, we're going to play some songs.
Right.
This is This is the soundtrack to our lives. This is our dad. This is our family. Well, and people really get that.
Great. And that segues perfectly to my next question was, how old were you when you first realized who your dad was and what he had accomplished?
Well, that's a very interesting question because for us, not to sound weird, but our whole family was famous.
Yes, exactly.
We thought it was really normal, you know, that people would come up and ask our grandparents for an autograph or, you know, and I'm talking both sides of the family. I mean, of course, right. You had Ozzie and Harriet, but on our mother's side of the family, our grandfather was Tom Harmon, mm-hmm. who won the Heisman Trophy in Michigan in 1940. His wife was beautiful and a movie star. And of course, our uncle, now super famous, Mark Harmon, yep. who plays Gibbs on NCIS. So for us, the family was always kind of, well, it's just kind of a family job. I didn't really know it was that big of a deal, honestly, until I went to my first concert that I knew, you know, it's like I just didn't know what it was. I think I was three. And we were on a vacation in Hawaii, actually. And I guess our dad was booked at a hotel. I didn't know that. But it was a huge ballroom, probably held, honestly, 2,500 people. And this music started, and I looked on stage and saw somebody looked a lot like my dad. And I thought, wow, that looks like Papa. And then everybody's applauding, and he's singing. And I said, well, that is Papa. And it just, I kind of made that connection between those people in the audience having a great time and him having a great time. And I thought, I mean, I was hooked instantly. It was one of those amazing, I mean, I always loved music. And he was right. building the Stone Canyon Band literally down the hallway from my nursery at the time. And so I guess Gunnar and I both were imprinted, and since we were twins, it worked out pretty well for us.
I think so. So let's get to this. You know, besides his pop and rockabilly legacy, Rick Nelson was actually something of a country rock pioneer. Do you? And yeah. as we learned in '72 with the release of the song Garden Party, do you think he gets sure. enough credit for that? Because country rock really became, you know, thanks mostly to the Eagles, but others, Linda Ronstadt uh-huh. and so on, became the sound of America, American music for quite some time and, you know, and still incredibly popular. Do you think that Rick Nelson yeah. deserves a little more credit for that?
Well, I think he's starting to get it. I mean, here's the truth. When he was inducted in the Rock Hall, a second year inductee, you know, it should have been first, to be honest with you. There was a lot of political reasons sure. why that didn't happen. But the truth was the Troubadour Club was down the street from us. We grew up in Hollywood, and that was really this hotbed of things that were happening in the late 60s. And you mentioned Linda Ronstadt. She was there with her first band, Stone Ponies. Mm-hmm. There was the Byrds, the Hollies, the Buffalo Springfield, you know, and Jackson Brown, Joni Mitchell. And here's the thing is our dad started the Stone Canyon Band. We talk about it in the show pretty much because he was challenged by his friend Bob Dylan, you know, basically mm-hmm. called him out and said, hey, come on, you know, you've been retired for a couple years since the show ended. Why don't you get out there? And he said, I really don't. He's like, look, you know, everybody thinks you're a joke. Why don't you prove them wrong? And so he put together this entire different trip. Now, this is 1968, you know, late 67, 68, and 69 it really blew up. And it was out of the Troubadour Club. And it's ironic that you mention the Eagles, because the Eagles were actually put together, as a lot of people know, as a backing band initially for Linda Ronstadt. But Randy Meisner came out of Poco and joined Rick Nelson in the Stone Canyon Band. And a couple of years later was a founding member of the Eagles. So this actually, our dad's band predated the Eagles big time. And I think that people that know the history of that whole, like, I guess it's called Southern California Sound yep. or Laurel Canyon thing, you know, for us, when Garden Party hit, you know, he had been playing this music for a few years. And actually, he wrote the song because he was doing new music and looking different and really kind of breaking free of that mm-hmm. teen idol thing. And there weren't too many people that actually had a chance to really do that. It took a lot of guts to do it, to be honest with you.
Sure.
He had a lot of doors shut in his face when he tried to reemerge. The Troubadour Club was a hot club, as I mentioned, and they wouldn't let him play there. Doug Weston wouldn't book him there, so he rented the club. And on the second night, there was a line around the block. People were buzzing about this new sound that Rick Nelson had. And these were predominantly kids. These weren't even the normal right. fans that he had. So it was a pretty neat thing to watch him do that, and a great lesson, something we talk about in the show, of course. You know, we have a whole thing mm-hmm. on the Stone Canyon Band, those great songs. I mean, there were a lot of them. And I'm very proud of our dad for doing that.
Wow. So had he lived, he would be 77 today, and assuming he was in good yep. health and still performing, what do you think he'd be into? Do you think, musically speaking, do you think he would have stayed in the country rock thing, or do you think he might have gone elsewhere as times changed?
Well, he kind of was, at the time that he passed away, he had kind of gotten back a little bit more stripped down to a, more of a rockabilly sound than a country sound. I mean, I'll be honest with you, kind of living – I live in Nashville now, and I know a lot of people here, musicians, songwriters, for 20 years, and so many of them were influenced by him and say that. I mean, I literally walked into people's recording studios with a picture of them as a kid with a little plastic guitar saying, that was me trying to be Ricky Nelson. No joke. And, like, I'm talking monster songwriters who've written big hits. I think our dad, honestly, would have probably been eventually talked into releasing an honest modern country album, and I think everybody would have joined up with him, and it would have been massive.
Yeah,
I honestly can't argue
with that. Absolutely, it would have.
Yeah. I just think it was there. I mean, my brother and I have been playing the show for years now, and the truth is, you know, we had a lot of success. You know, I shudder to say, because, you know, we're now considered guys from the hair band era, but we were really more like a heavy California sound is really what we were going for. And, you know, I think that now that we've been for years playing our dad's tunes, aside from the stuff that we do as well, it's kind of like our Rosetta Stone. We touch base with it and move on. But the fact is we've been playing, you know, more of like an Americana slash country sound for far longer than we had success as, you know, heavy pop band. And I think that now that I kind of see the musical DNA with it, going all the way back to his 50s rockabilly stuff through the 60s and the country rock thing through the 70s, I mean, he really was a pioneer in every sense, really super legitimate. And as you mentioned, I think, yeah, he would be, 77 now, 78
yeah,
years old. He would be stunningly gorgeous because he just was.
Yeah.
He's a great looking
guy. Absolutely.
He was embarrassed about it.
Do you think he would have, like so many people, including Dylan and Rod Stewart and Linda Ronstadt, gotten into the whole, you know, American songbook, Great American Songbook thing? Do you think that was that something?
That would be tough to – it's interesting you say that. Maybe. I know that if you were a Ricky Nelson fan back in the beginning, you know, his father, our grandfather,
right.
Ozzy, was a band leader. And so a lot of the material – that our dad cut was actually big band era songs that he would recut. Like, let's just say the Johnny Mercer song, Fools Rush In. He had a big hit with it in the 60s, but that was a 40s song. I think actually, no, 30s. And, you know, so, yeah, I think he probably definitely would have pulled a Rod Stewart.
Yeah, I think so,
you know?
Too. Yeah, his voice certainly lent itself to that. So,
it was like velvet.
Yeah, absolutely. So changing gears a little. So the recent debut of ABC's boy band competition series, to me anyway, is just another sign of the full-blown 1990s revival. It's pretty much – it's probably here already, but it's coming even more so as time goes on.
Oh,
so,
gosh.
So do you see a time when your priority may switch back to your own music rather than dad's?
Well, I mean, it kind of is. I'll be honest with you. We, for the last year or so – a lot of people don't know this. Gunnar and I have kind of started to reemerge as we kind of want to be the quintessential acoustic rock group, you know, and Gunnar and I always, two guys, two brothers, two guitars. You know, we went out with Styx and Frampton opening for them just like that, you know, in arenas and stuff like that. And we kind of, you know, we've been kind of laying low a little bit, I think, because a lot of bands from that era, it not only was it kind of not really their time, but it's kind of come around now to where we're starting to get calls and people are saying, hey, man, I really grew up with your stuff. Can you bring that back out again? We're going to do that, but we also have some new stuff as well that's going to surprise some people. But, you know, Nelson still goes out and performs, and we're going to be doing a lot more of those shows.
Wonderful. That's good news. And we've been talking to Matthew Nelson of the band Nelson, but these days doing a show with his twin brother, Gunnar. Ricky Nelson Remembered. I hope I got that right this time. And,
you got it.
They'll be at Borgata this Friday night. If you're a Ricky Nelson fan, you should be. I don't even want to hear about it. If you're not, you got to see the show. And one last question. Before we say goodbye, I have to ask you about your grandparents. Before they were married and had two sons, Harriet Hilliard was a well-known actress and singer. Ozzie Nelson was, as you've noted, an extremely successful band leader. So what was your relationship with them, and how important is their legacy, as opposed to Ricky's, to you?
Wow. First of all, they're both inspirations to both my brother and myself, and I think our entire family. I was incredibly close with Grandma Harriet. She passed away in 94, so she actually came to our concerts and things like when Nelson blew up.
That's great.
And gave us lots of advice. And, you know, it's very humbling when somebody says, you know, why is it taking you so long to make a record? We used to go in and cut 14 sides a night. You know,
right.
And they were good. And our grandfather, you know, see, our family is a Jersey family.
Right.
I don't know if
that's
a lot
right.
of people know that, you know. Yeah, mm-hmm. So they're from New Jersey.
He went to
Gunnar
Rutgers.
And I spent a lot of time.
He's a Rutgers guy.
He had a law degree from Rutgers, actually. He said his crowning achievement in his life was winding up as the quarterback of the Rutgers football team, even though he weighed 136 pounds soaking wet. He also, as you mentioned, band leader, law degree, managed to raise, you know, a younger kid brother that, you know, when his father died. I mean, he still holds a record as the world's youngest Eagle Scout in the Boy Scouts of America. I mean, he was just a complete overachiever type of guy, but completely sweet. I lost him when I was 10 years old, but I got a chance to know Grandpa. And the thing about him was, and it's still to this day, I really believe this, when our grandfather Ozzie passed away, there was this huge vacuum in the Nelson family. I mean, our parents wound up starting to have problems and wound up divorcing a couple of years later. Mm-hmm. It's almost like the rudder fell off the ship. And so that was a real inspiration. And he was one of those guys that, you know, he wrote, produced, edited, yep. directed, and starred in all 435 episodes of the show. And they had a radio show that they did with a completely different script for the first 2 years of Ozzie and Harriet because he thought television was a fad and was going to go away. So, you know, he was one of those guys, total inspirations, but I think what it was I really learned, and my brother Gunnar really learned, that above anything, you know, we're professional entertainers, but we're real people. And I never saw anybody in my family have a celebrity moment.
Right.
You know, I never saw any of them act like they were better than anybody else because they didn't feel they were. They always signed every autograph. They always took time. My grandmother, if somebody wrote her a 6-page letter, she'd write them a 7-page letter back.
That's great.
It was just that type of thing. And Gunnar and I still meet everybody who wants to meet us at the end of our shows, which we couldn't do when Nelson was completely crazy in 1990 because people would, you know, rip our clothes off.
Right.
This is different. And at the Borgata, you know, this to us is we're visiting not only with our fans, but with our dad's fans, with our grandparents' fans. It's a really wonderful night. We're going to make people laugh. We're going to make them cry. It's a fun experience, but people don't forget it, and it just keeps getting bigger every year.
Well, that's a great place to end it. Matthew Nelson, thank you so, so much for taking the time to chat with us today, and we will absolutely see you at Borgata Friday night, I believe it is, in Atlantic City.
Yes, it is, and it's going to be like our hometown gig. You know, we're looking forward to coming back.
Jersey, baby.
The area. Yep,
great.
You got it.
Take care and continued success, and we'll hopefully talk to you again one day.
I really hope so. I'll see you later.
Thanks.
Kelly Pickler, live in concert. Saturday, August 5th, 9 p.m., the Event Center at Sugar House Casino. TV and country music superstar, Kelly Pickler, live. On tour in support of her latest CD. Tickets on sale now at SugarHouseCasino.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Don't miss an incredible night live with Kelly Pickler.
Hey, we be back. Indeed, I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you go see this Friday at Borgata. Definitely check out the show. I saw him do it years and years ago at the old Atlantic City Hilton. And it was a really cool show. If you're a Ricky Nelson fan, and you should be, because the guy was a real talent. He wasn't just, you know, a TV star, you know, lucky, what do you say, lucky sperm club. I mean, yes, he was born to those people, but he was a talent in and of himself, and very cool. Anyway, we're going to move on now, and we're going to move on to who else but Adi Amoroso. We're on a roll. Adi Amorosi. Oh, man. See what happens when you take a week off? You just lose everything. And, of course, you read them in Philly.com, in the Inquirer, in the Daily News, and Philly Weekly, and so on and so forth, Icon Magazine, and Philly Style Magazine. And he's just the hardest working man in showbiz these days, as I refer to him. What's going on?
Number one, you're right. It's so hard to get back in the groove after a week off, but here we are.
Grooving.
And secondly, I have got to say, that was a charming interview
with Mr.
Nelson. That was, you know, I adore their father's work and admire their harmonies. And, you know, it was a nice link together. You should do this more often, whatever it is you're doing.
If I knew what it was, I would.
Right?
So that's the music of the past. Let's talk about the music of the present and maybe the future, meaning the next week or so in Philly.
Sure. Tomorrow night, there's going to be a show with Rod Stewart and Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah.
At the BB&T.
Yep.
In Camden. You know, we've seen shows in the last couple years. Rod is paired up with Steve Winwood. Rod is paired off with Stevie Nicks. We've seen the Paul Simon and Sting gigs. One thing that we're really hoping that happens here, because it doesn't always happen between the acts. These guys, Rod Stewart and Cyndi Lauper, actually did sing together.
Which is really cool. I'm sorry. Go ahead, finish. Okay.
No. They sang together in 1985 for a benefit in Los Angeles. They did People Get Ready. They did Time After Time. And they did I Heard It Through the Grapevine. Now, so rarely, other than when Sting gets together with Peter Gabriel and Paul Simon, stuff like that. But other than that, you know, none of these acts take advantage of the fact that they could be doing something together and really thrilling crowds. So here's hoping that, you know, Rod Stewart, who is back to singing his own classic songbook as opposed to Tin Pan Alley stuff.
Right.
And Cyndi Lauper, who, you know, vacillates between doing her poppy new wave stuff and Broadway material. Here's hoping that the two of them get together.
Well, do we know? We don't know if they are, though.
There is a rumor that they're going to do something in Camden, and may very well carry it forward. I don't know if it's anything. I would imagine at the very least doing Time After Time, because there is a YouTube on that is just gorgeous to hear. So be nice to see the two of them do that.
I'll tell you what song I can hear Rod doing. And so if it were up to me, the first song I would suggest would be Time After Time.
Yeah, sure.
I would love to hear Rod and her do that together.
You know, that's a song. You know, the funny thing is, I remember not particularly liking it when it first came out, but then I heard Miles Davis do it. And in such a pensive, spooky, and still optimistic rendition that I thought, well, this is how modern classics start, when someone of that caliber and that advanced in aesthetic can turn it into something beautiful and unique in, you know, within his own canon. So yeah, it'd be great to hear the two of them do that. So let's
I'm actually reading
the front and start yelling.
I'm reading a review here from Tampa the other night, and it doesn't say anything at all about them to get played together. And certainly Cyndi Lauper, who's Philadelphia, a little debt of gratitude, so maybe a little payback, because it was Philadelphia that gave her her career. Her producer was Rick Chertoff, a former Philadelphian.
Right.
Of course, Robert Hazard.
The Hooters wrote with her.
Robert Hazard wrote Girls Just Want to Have Fun, the Hooters.
Really,
if you listen, you know, that first album, which is a masterpiece by any measuring stick, but the Hooters,
sure.
It's really so much about the Hooters arrangements, because, as I'm sure you know, Girls Just Want to Have Fun was a punk song when Robert did it.
Yes, it was.
They turned it into, I don't even know what you call it, except just great pop. So, yeah, so she owes us big time, baby.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's form a conga line in front. What are you going to do? Sticking with the locals for one second, maybe not quite as well known as Cyndi Lauper, but the Spinto Band are from Wilmington, Delaware, and they've been around since like the mid-90s. How a lot of people came to know them was that after they had recorded a record called Nice and Nicely Done for the Bar None label, one of its songs, Oh Mandy, got pulled off the record by Sears and used for like a dozen commercials. And, you know, so at least for a while, these guys could coast off of, you know, Sears and Roebuck money.
Yeah, which is always good.
To pay their way for everything they did since. They're still
mailbox,
around.
It's called mailbox money.
Right, mailbox money, exactly. I feel, oh my God, I forgot that term. These guys are, you know, are still around. They don't do, they don't tour too much, but they just reissued that very same album, nice and nicely done, and they're going to play at Boot and Saddle on the 14th. And, you know, anyone who likes artsy, kinksish pop, I recommend they head over to Boot and Saddle. It's a tiny room.
Right.
So get there early. And to close out the weekend, this is something, you know, I always gripe at newspapers that I work for that we never cover enough Latin music in the area. So on the 16th, WXPN gets together with a local Latin continuum music promoter called Afritano, and they're presenting now the fifth Nuevo Fest at Fringe Arts on Sunday, July 16th. It starts at 1 p.m. It's actually free if you get to XPN's website early enough. And for anyone who's wondering, well, I don't know if I can, if I get Latin music, I don't know how, my point of entry. There is a band called El Mariachi Manchester, and they're from East Los Angeles, and they're a five-piece mariachi ensemble who plays Morrissey and Smith's
really
and for anybody who knows anything about East Los Angeles, Morrissey is worshipped
really
by the Mexican community.
We have to cut it short because we got to move on. But I want to pick this up next week. This is fascinating. So let's try to remember. I want to hear why the Mexican community in L.A. is so into Morrissey and the Smiths. This is fascinating. But thank you, as always, for your insight. And we will chat again next week. A.D. Amorosi, everybody.
Right.
And we're going to go right to them with no delay whatsoever to our movie lady who always wraps things up in such a lovely fashion. And that, of course, is Leanne Lindsay at TinselTime.com.
Hi, Chuck.
Hey.
I thought you almost forgot about me.
Ah, I'd never forget about you. You know that. You give this show some class.
You know, that's saying a lot. Oh, well, it's great to be back.
Yes.
After our little hiatus.
Yep.
And, of course, this past week, Spider-Man Homecoming took the honors as a top box office.
More importantly, it actually got some really good reviews.
It did get some very good reviews, directed by John Watts. And, you know, this is, of course, the third Spider-Man in 15 years. So to be able to get those good reviews means a lot. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Tom Holland is a really good comedic young actor. He also spent his formative years playing Billy Elliot on the London stage, so he has that agility and he has that like self-effacing quality, and he really makes a fun young friend.
So he's British. So he is British.
Right.
Okay, which is, I wrote a column for Philly Voice, what was it, last week, I guess, 2 weeks ago? Yeah, 2 weeks ago, that suggested that I don't like when British actors play American roles. It doesn't make any sense to me. No. It's like what? There aren't any, there's no actors, no American actors that they can find to do the role that they have to ask British people to put on American accents, really?
Put on American accents, and it happens so often.
I know.
I wonder how often it happens in reverse.
I don't know, but
like,
I bet you're not
that
near.
Happen?
I'll bet I can't give you any examples, but maybe on British television.
Neither can I.
There you go.
I have to be like more into British movies and television than saying, oh yeah, well they tried the British accent. I don't know, but I don't know, but I do like the fact that they used Michael Keaton as the villain. For two reasons. One, because it's, you know, that little sort of tongue-in-cheek with him having been Batman.
Right.
And gotten the nomination for the Oscars for the Birdman, and now he's called the Vulture. But also because, you know, so often with these comic book movies, which, you know, of course I love, but it's all about world dominion. Like, you know, so the villain has to take over the world.
Right.
This guy's not trying to do that. He's a normal blue-collar guy who kind of feels like he got cheated. He's kind of playing that whole forgotten man syndrome that our country is all about right now. And, you know, he just feels like, you know, he's got to play dirty in order to make certain his family is fed and he's getting, you know, getting his own. So it's a little different, and I like it. And of course, Michael Keaton is really great in it.
Well, of course, yes.
And then last week, or the week before, we wanted to talk about The Beguiled. And then for anybody who doesn't know, it is directed by Sofia Coppola, who is, of course, the daughter of famed Godfather director and California winery owner Francis Ford Coppola. And for just to remind people also, she was the first American woman ever nominated for a Best Director Oscar, which was for Lost in Translation
right.
in 2014. And now she got awarded the honor for Best Direction at the Cannes Film Festival for The Beguiled. So that's pretty great.
I'm sorry. I was going to ask a question about that Spider-Man was the only movie, new movie, it looks like it was the only new movie released last week. Are we now done the big summer openings?
No, because this Friday opens Planet of the Apes.
War for the Planet of the Apes,
the third in that franchise. Yeah, so no, we still got another big one coming up. But yeah, for just to give a little quickie, the Beguiled takes place during the Civil War at a girls' southern boarding school where five young girls are varying ages and two teachers remain somewhat cut off from everyone. The slaves have all left and the women are managing on their own. So this is where this controversy comes in, because Sofia Coppola is being accused of whitewashing the movie by removing the slave
literally
character.
Literally.
Right. Right. And I understand from the book, which was written in 1966 by Thomas P. Cullinan, there was another biracial character who passed for white. She was the teacher, but she was biracial. And that character was also eliminated in the version starring Clint Eastwood in 1971. Now, in this version, Coppola keeps that character in, but she's just white, and she's played by Kirsten Dunst. So she said that she didn't want to deal with the issue of race, that she didn't feel qualified, which I understand. And I feel, though, even though the movie does take place during the Civil War, there can be stories told about people affected by the war, but maybe it not be mainly about the issue of slavery.
Well, right, because what? That's a great point, because I don't know what the numbers were, but I do know that, you know, a fairly small percentage of Southerners actually owned slaves. The majority, certainly the majority of rank and file soldiers in the Civil War were not slave owners. They weren't even land, you know, they were poor. They were, you know, they worked their farm and that was it.
Too poor to.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's.
So they didn't.
And you know what? You got to give her credit for letting her artistic vision, or not letting political correctness get in the way of her specific or singular artistic vision. There's something to be said for that. Yes?
Which I do agree with. But what happens is like when she says, I want to focus on the gender dynamics rather than the racial ones, a lot of the black pundits felt like that implied to her way of thinking gender dynamics can only be explored between white males and white females. I know that's not what you mean.
Right.
I mean, the way the screenplay is written, if you added characters of color, especially during the Civil War, it would add layers.
Right. It's a whole nother.
Not everybody's background is
right.
the same.
It's a whole nother. It's a whole nother. Whole nother movie.
It's a whole other movie.
Yeah, so
it wouldn't really
right.
work.
But do you? We have to wrap it up. I mean, so you recommend the movie, regardless or despite?
But I recommend it as you don't need to go to the movie theater to see it.
Yeah.
You could definitely
right, and of course
and
there's
right.
an
but
example
it's
of
beautiful though
of an Australian woman playing an American woman. Oh well.
that's true with Nicole Kidman. You're yeah. right. But she does that all the time. So
anyway,
we're kind of used
anyway,
to it.
Anyway, if you go to tinseltown.com, free screening tickets, baby, the best offer in town. You get to see all the new movies. You get to see them for free, and you get to see them a couple days before the rest of the universe. What could be better than that? So please check out that website. And, of course, you're going to give Aunt Nucky a big birthday hug and kiss for me. Right?
Yes. She had a great birthday.
Good.
Thank you.
Glad to hear that. All right, kiddo. We'll talk next week.
All right.
Take care.
Bye.
And real fast, you know, it's picnic season, right? And why go through making the sandwiches yourself, going to the store and buying the mayo and buying the cold cuts when you can just make a call to my guys over at the Kibitz Room at the Holly Ravine Plaza, 100 Springdale Road in Cherry Hill. You know, whatever you want. You want sandwiches? Well, you already know that they got the best sandwiches around. And they have all the salads you could possibly want. I mean, you know, just like salad after salad. And I'm not talking about salad bowls like Greek salads or Caesar salad, which you can also get. But, you know, I'm talking about things like, oh, I don't know what, like potato salad and coleslaw and shrimp salad, you know, things like that that just can make a picnic. So don't bother. Just get on the phone. Get on the computer. You go on the phone. You call them 856-428-7878. You get on the computer and you go to greatpastrami.com, and those guys will take care of everything for you for your picnic, except the ants. Those you have to provide yourself. All right? So now what happens? Oh, right. I guess I say goodbye, right? Is that what happens? What happens? I still, what is it? I said, it's time to go. I just read it, and then it says Chuck Close. Anyway, we're almost out of time. I want to thank my special guest, Matthew Nelson. Go see Nelson. Salute their dad, Ricky Nelson, Friday night at Borgata. Thanks to all my regular contributors, Neil Zorin and Nady Amorosi and Bruce Klauber and Leanne Lindsay. And, of course, keeping everything on track in Michigan Trail, we got my producer, Brett Kronberger. Good job, buddy. And we will be here next week. We thought we were going to be able to tell you who the guest is, but that didn't happen. That's the way it works sometimes. But in the meantime, remember, as you go through this farce through called life, you only need to remember one thing and one thing only. Hey, that's showbiz. Ethel, take us home.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere.